Yeah, I'm Salman Habib, and I guess I am interested in this stuff, so you'll hear about it more or less. Okay, so, well, there's a lot of people here who have contributed to quantum chaos, to quantum decoherence, to continuous measurement theory, and other aspects of this talk. So, you know, feel free to abuse me at any point. I've given some of these, similar talks before, and some of the people here, many of them have heard them, so I'm in a sense a little bit embarrassed, but I guess I have to get over that. So the idea of this talk is to first talk a little bit about the formal relationship between quantum and classical mechanics and highlight some of the difficulties in this relationship. So I won't be talking too much about things like interference and entanglement, but some other more, you know, dynamically, in my view, important symmetries and why they don't quite pan out, okay? And then I'll worry about these formal correspondence issues, discuss them a little bit, because, and then go on to discuss chaos and are its essential features. Again, everyone here knows, but, you know, never hurts to remind oneself a little bit. And then I would like to argue that in order to deal with those features of chaos, because chaos has to be an emergent property of quantum mechanics. The world is quantum mechanical, and we just have to deal with it. And so we have to figure out how to get classical chaos from quantum mechanics. And in order to do that, you know, we have to understand, you know, precisely what the operational procedure is going to be. And in order to do that, we have to go beyond thinking about distributions and start thinking in terms of effective trajectories. And so once you do that, you can go back again and see how the classical limit is regained. And then you can study how chaos actually emerges from the quantum mechanical background. And if I have time, I may throw in some extra remarks, or maybe I won't. Well, one of the acknowledgments I've listed here are really very key, because a lot of this work relies on having huge supercomputers. Without them, essentially all of nonlinear dynamics now would be non-existent. So this is really not just a trivial acknowledgment. The main references are cited here. There's a PRL that appeared in December. There should be another one coming out soon. There's a bunch of other papers. Okay. So obviously the quantum classical transition is of great interest. And I think what should be stressed, I mean, you can certainly read the transparency and you'll see why it's of great interest. But one of the things that should be stressed is that it's becoming of really, really much more important now, because experiments have gotten to a very interesting stage. I mean, quantum and atomic optics experiments have always been really, really precise, but now they are becoming more than just precise. I believe they are in some sense becoming spectacular, because you can actually take single quantum objects, like a single atom, trap it in a high finesse cavity, and observe it and try and control it. Once you do that, you really have to understand the quantum theory of single systems and the idea of how a classical-like trajectory from quantum state estimation can emerge. At the same time, experiments in condensed matter physics are also getting much better. Of course, they are dirtier mesoscopics, as we all know. It's a much harder game. But nevertheless, one has the feeling that in the next 5 or 6 years, the experimental state of the art there, for instance, already now in nanomechanical systems and single electron transistor readouts, there are continuous quantum measurement theories for such things, and they are being developed as we speak. And I think, really, experiment is going to drive this field and not theory, which I think is an extremely welcome, you know, event, because as theorists, I think people often argue about stuff that really is irrelevant, but when it comes down to predicting numbers, you know, there's no argument. Either you're right or you're wrong. And in that sense, I think also one of the things I really want to stress is that pretty soon we'll be in a situation where we'll be able to observe quantum mechanical systems and be able to control them. And this is going to be the acid test for measurement theory, because right now we do mainly estimation, but estimating a state and then using it to feedback and control a system and having that control work is a final test for whether you understand quantum measurement theory. So I think all these very exciting, this exciting future is actually not so far ahead. We hope to hit it in the next 5 years or so. At any rate, with that pep talk, I'll go on to something more formal about how to really view quantum and classical mechanics. So basically there are two different ways that these two dynamical systems have been treated in the literature. One is as ideal mechanical systems, ideal dynamical systems. So there is a classical mechanics which has an asset, you know, which has its axioms, and you can develop it from there. There's quantum mechanics which has its axioms, and you can develop it from there. And then you can ask, you know, do these two theories talk to each other? How do they talk to each other? What are the problems? Okay, so obviously I think most people here, I mean, you might do that. That's an interesting game to play mathematically. But most of us believe, obviously, that, well, maybe not obviously, but most of us believe that there is the one true theory, which is quantum mechanics, and some sort of effective classical mechanics arises from it by, you know, decoherence or entanglements or measurements or whatever. People use different words. In the end, we all do more or less similar calculations. And so the type of questions that one asks, I mean, I'll discuss a few of these questions. I won't bother going into too much detail about what's over here, except to say that there are a lot of interesting questions which simply have to do with how you compare quantum and classical systems with each other. So let me start by looking at a few formal mathematical difficulties. So the first problem, obviously, is that, you know, we are taught that classical mechanics isn't the probabilistic theory, and the end quantum mechanics is, so you have to deal with that. But that's not really a big deal at all, because after all, classical mechanics also is a probabilistic theory. All you have to do is write down the classical Liouville equation for the distribution function in phase space. That's a nice linear equation. And this allows the treatment of probabilistic initial conditions. There is one minor remark I make here, which is that because of Liouville's theorem, any function of a classical phase space distribution function is preserved in time. You know, any function that's integrated over phase space is preserved in time. So in particular, if you take the distribution and take it to some power and integrate it, that's preserved in time, okay, as long as this integral exists. Now, an analogous formalism exists in quantum mechanics. It's called the Wigner formalism. I think everyone here is familiar with it, so I won't belabor it. But all it is just a different way of rewriting a density matrix. So it has no more or less information than the density matrix. And using it, you can calculate expectation values. It has some nice properties in the sense that it's normalized to 1, and it gives you the right marginals and so forth. The only problem with the Wigner, well, one problem with the Wigner function is that you shouldn't interpret it literally as a probability distribution, and that's because it's not positive definite. So here's an example of what, you know, Wigner function might look like, and usually it looks very horrible, and later on I'll show you some a nice, colorful, and extremely horrible slide of a Wigner function. The important thing to note is that it is usually, so this is an example, I think this is a linear potential, and so this is a bounce in phase space of the Wigner function. So the classical trajectories are on the rim, and there are interference shadows on the inside. These interference shadows can be arbitrarily complicated and can go down to very small scales, sub H bar scales. But that's not really my main concern here. In fact, one of the concerns I would say that people have had in the past is that there's been a lot of worry about all these shadows and how do we get rid of them. And this is basically what the decoherence program has been about. But I would like to talk about something a little different, which is that there's another dynamical problem in comparing quantum and classical systems, which is that, so how do we compare them? Well, these are, after all, two different dynamical theories. So one nice way to do that is to look at the evolution equation for the Wigner function. And what the evolution equation for the Wigner function looks like, it looks like the classical Liouville equation, but then it has a quantum term. And for potentials that can be Taylor expanded, the quantum term looks like this. You know, it's important to understand that there's a major misconception of this particular term which many people have, which I would like to correct. If you don't have it, I'm sorry, but if you do, it's important to remember that this h bar over here, even though it seemingly comes as h bar squared, the first term can often be of order 0. Okay. So the first correction can often be classical, quote unquote. And you will see that, I will explain that, and you will see why that has to be the case. Okay, so this thing is not really a pure quantum mechanical piece in a certain sense. Okay, so now let's ask about this thing which I call the classical approximation. The classical approximation is basically something very simple. I just drop the quantum corrections to the evolution. I forget about them and I say, give me some initial Wigner function. It could be something that's not positive definite, I don't care. And I'll just evolve it using the Liouville operator, the classical Liouville operator. And this I can do using particle sampling methods. And people do this in chemical physics a lot. In plasma physics, there's this method is called the delta F method, and it's no big deal. You can just do it. And even in field theory, often people do this because, after all, the corresponding problem in field theory is evolving a functional, quantum functional, which is insanely difficult. No one has any idea how to do it. So quite often what you do is you just replace it by solving classical wave equations. And that's cheating, and that's exactly this cheat. That's the classical approximation. So what's the main problem with the classical approximation? The main problem is that, aside from giving you the wrong answer, it also has the wrong dynamical symmetry. It violates unitarity. And often when you tell somebody, you know, classical mechanics violates unitarity, and they kind of look at you like, are you crazy or what? But when you, once you understand in what context I'm talking about, it makes perfect sense. So let me give you a proof by counter example, which I've bored countless numbers of people with. So here's the proof. Let's take an initial condition, and let that be a pure Gaussian state. The nice thing about having a wave function that's a pure Gaussian wave function is that the corresponding Wigner function is also Gaussian and is positive everywhere. So it looks like a completely harmless classical distribution. So then let's take that and evolve it by, you know, in your favorite nonlinear classical potential. Why nonlinear? It's because for linear potentials, quantum and classical propagators are the same, so it's kind of pointless to do that. So let's evolve it in some nonlinear potential. Well, after some time, let's stop evolving it. At this point, I have this object. It's some classical distribution, so it's clearly positive, right? It's everywhere greater than zero, and it is also not Gaussian anymore because I evolved it in some nonlinear potential. So now I ask this object, you know, are you still a Wigner function? So the answer comes in three steps. Well, first of all, maybe it's a pure state, but there's a problem with that. And the problem is that the only pure state that's positive everywhere is a Gaussian state. That's called Hudson's theorem, proven in 1974. So it's not a pure state. Well, maybe it's a mixed state of some sort. Unfortunately, it can't be a mixed state because remember I told you earlier that you know any function of f integrated over space is a constant. In particular, f squared integrated over phase space is a constant, but f squared is trace rho squared, essentially. So therefore, it can't be a mixed state because I started with a pure state, and if it is a state at all, that hasn't changed. So it's not a mixed state. Unfortunately then, therefore, it's not a state at all. What it means is that if I take this object and undo the Wigner transform, do what's called a Weyl transform, I'll find something which looks like a density matrix, except it has negative eigenvalues. Okay. So therefore, we have a problem. So what sort of problem is this anyway? So the interesting point is basically this. That for the moment, let's forget this irreversible operator over here. Okay, let's not think about it. So naively, you know, if you look at this particular evolution, you know, naively you might say, well, gee, you know, LQ is a quantum operator of some kind, so it better be unitary, or there's something wrong. In which case, L classical should be unitary too, because the sum of these is clearly unitary. It's a linear operator. But I just told you L classical is not unitary. In fact, it's not positive. Okay. So therefore, LQ is a non-positive operator as well, and the sum gives you a positive operator, or a unitary operator in this particular case. So it is not true that LQ is something that only has produced some quantum interference garbage and nothing else. In fact, if you didn't have this, you know, this whole evolution wouldn't be unitary. So that compensating part of it is very, very important, can be very, very important. So in particular, we see already that if the classical positivity violation is very, very large, decoherence by itself cannot restore symplectic classical evolution. So what do I mean by that? Usually, you know, this irreversible part comes in when you couple to an environment. And one of the harsh facts of life is that it's very hard avoiding coupling to some environment. Okay, and so what happens if you have a decohering environment, I mean, not saying this is what happens typically, but in many simple models and in the real world, quite often, the interesting part that comes out of the irreversible operator is a diffusion term. This particular diffusion term tends to smear out those fast quantum interferences I showed you earlier in that picture. And the naive sort of heuristic argument, which all of us make, is that this smearing, you know, washes out the interference terms in here. And, you know, that's all these two terms do. They kind of sort of cancel each other out to some approximation. maybe there's a little bit of noise left, but essentially this thing dominates. Okay. However, if this thing is very, very badly non-positive, it can't possibly dominate because its whole evolution is positive. So it's more positive. So this piece cannot possibly dominate if it's badly positive. In other words, this guy can smear this, but it has to leave a big non-positive piece behind, which has to cancel a non-positive piece in the other case. So if that's the case, then you can't possibly have, you know, symplectic classical evolution. You'll have something else, and I'll show you an example of that. So depending on whether the classical dynamics is strongly non-positive or not, you could have what we call strong or weak violation of the correspondence principle. I'll explain that in a second. It turns out that this has nothing to do with chaos, per se. This is also kind of amusing. We have examples where you have very, very chaotic systems that are only weakly violating of correspondence, and examples of chaotic systems that are strongly violating of correspondence. So the mere presence of chaos is irrelevant. So one very simple test of looking for positivity violation is simply to do what I said earlier, which is look at the eigenvalues of the so-called classical density matrix, and here's an example. Now this involves going to a supercomputer and writing some large programs and, you know, grinding away for several hours, days, weeks, you know, however long it takes. And what you find is for the quantum delta kick rotor, which is an example of strong violation, let's look at that. If you look at the quantum delta kick rotor, all the eigenvalues are nice and positive, right, which they must be. If you look at the classical delta kick rotor run with the same parameters, there's a very strong negative tail. On the other hand, if you look at the Duffing dynamical system, you see that there's a very, very small amount of classical violation. So this is actually a pretty good test, it turns out, of whether a system is strongly or weakly violated. So let me give you an example of a system which has been experimentally looked at in many, many labs, and which we hope to understand better, both experimentally and theoretically, and several teams are working on this. But so what this is the quantum delta kick rotor. So that's the Hamiltonian over there. And what we are looking at here is the evolution of p squared as a function of time. What happens is that if you don't couple this system to an external environment, you have for large, you know, space and parameters, something called dynamical localization, which is the dynamical analog of Anderson localization. And you see that p squared stops evolving. On the other hand, if you had the classical system, and if you evolved it, you would get a diffusive behavior in p squared. And for small couplings to the environment, like d value of 0.1 with the parameters I picked here, this thing really doesn't make any difference. You simply get the same evolution as you would have got without any coupling to the outside world. On the other hand, if you take the quantum system and add d of 0.1, you see that dynamical localization breaks, but you don't get the classical limit. In order to get the classical limit, you have to sometimes drive these systems with enormous amounts of noises in the experiments, 200%, 60%, you know, over the normal systematic forces. So this is a very, very good example of a system in which we don't have a classical limit. Now,
the quantum system shows initially the same diffusion.
It doesn't. It depends on parameters. Even that doesn't work. So even the whole notion of break time in this system fails. I'll draw it on chalk after the talk to show you.
The supercomputer didn't have graphics output.
Oh, well, no, this is because I was asked by certain organizers to give this talk a little late. But yeah, in fact, it doesn't have graphics also. I use Nuplot most of the time. No one talk to me about Max. Okay, so here's further elucidation of this particular point. So essentially, what I'm saying now is that decoherence can be successful in that you can smear out all the interference junk, okay? But you can still be left with a positive distribution, which naively, you know, you would look at and say, oh, looks classical to me, but this does not evolve classically at all, okay? So to check that, it's very simple. You define this function, which is just the Wigner function minus its absolute magnitude, and you can put a minus sign in front or not. In this particular graph, there was a missing minus sign. And obviously, if the absolute value is equal to the function, then it's zero. So what happens now is this blue curve is when there's no coupling to the outside world, and you find that the integrated negativity of the Wigner function increases, and increases quite a lot. And this is just a sign that there's lots of interference being built up. On the other hand, when you couple it to an environment, you see that this thing very rapidly goes to zero. So the Wigner function gets completely decoherent. It looks like some sort of sigmoid thing. It's very nice and smooth. Nevertheless, its evolution, as you saw from the previous slide, is not classical in the least. So this is an interesting example of how you can have distributions that are classically interpretable. These are one particle distributions, so the entanglement isn't an issue here. But they can't be connected by the naive Hamiltonian dynamics you would have connected them with. So this is the even simpler version of Kahl's, you know, NMR analysis. Okay.
So
you don't believe that anymore? Okay, but this is right. So you have to believe this no matter what. So now let me go on to another system where, well, it depends on what you don't believe, but we can talk about that a little bit. So here, yeah. So here, now I give you an example of a system that actually is extremely, does behave very well in terms of correspondence, and this is a Duffing oscillator. And this has been looked at by lots of people, first popularized by Lin and Ballantyne, and then, but here, so, I mean, I guess this transparency is not very easy to look at, but the fundamental thing you should get out from this is that there are two dynamics going on over here. One of them is a classical, one of them is a quantum. And there are different quantities being plotted. At the top, we have expect of x. At the bottom, here we have the variance, here we have the third, and here is the fourth moment, and so on. Okay, and right at the bottom, there's some high power of the momentum. The amazing thing is that the quantum and classical averages agree extremely well. And this we have done to dynamical timescales going to about hundreds of drives. And bottom line is the difference. So the bottom line is the difference. The difference always stays small, few percent. And what we don't understand is why, you know, at some point it seems to go bad. This seems to happen in all the simulations. We have checked that it's not a logarithmic of H bar scaling now, so it's not a break time. But it seems to correspond to, and it's not the Ehrenfest time either. We have no idea what it is. Okay.
What's the Duffing oscillator?
It's a quartic oscillator. So it's, in this case, it's plus x to the fourth minus x squared plus x cos omega t. So it's a double well, and it's got a drive.
Okay. And how do you get approximation there?
Sorry?
How do you do the approximation?
The classical approximation,
yeah.
You mean? We take an enormous number of particles and just run them in trajectories, like something like, I think in this case, 10 million, and do very precise simulation, and then just take the averages. So now, just to show you that just because the system is only weakly violating doesn't mean that the Wigner function in this particular case looks particularly classical. It doesn't. It looks like a total mess. So here's an example. Here's the mess I promised to show you. So this is a Wigner function in space. This is a very high resolution simulation, and you can see that structures form on very, very small scales. This box is the H-bar box, okay, in phase space. So this is a standard thing. People have known about this for a long time. Now what happens is when you turn on decoherence, you know, which is just the coupling to the environment, what you find is that the classical distribution that comes out, well, quasi-classical from the Wigner evolution, is very close to the true classical distribution. So the one at the bottom is the classical distribution. The one at the top is the decoherent quantum distribution. They look really, really good.
And that's for every value? Or, I mean, that's true?
That's the full distribution.
Turn on the
No, this is the continued decoherence, right? It has gone on.
So that's after a long time.
Yeah, in this particular case, not too long, but like you can tell, it's like.
It's the same H bar font.
Yeah,
but
it's exactly the same.
The plots that you showed us of those moments were done without decoherence.
Yes, that's right.
So the point there is that.
The point there was that even without decoherence. Yeah.
The break time because it's a chaotic system, but you don't see it.
Well, I don't see it. We've looked at other systems too, and this, to me, is perplexing. I'm happy to discuss this later because, well, there are other things there to think about.
Is your observed break time longer or shorter than what you expected to
make? It's roughly in the same ballpark, but it has the wrong scaling, because now I've checked the scaling, because previously I didn't have enough computing power to check the scaling. It doesn't look log. I don't know what it is. Looks more like...
It's monotonous.
It seems to be monotonic.
It's
not in the right way. That's why it's not logged.
It's monotonous.
It's monotonous.
It decreases time.
Yeah. That seems to be the case. But I should just say that that's in this particular system. In other systems, there is no break time at all that you can even define sometimes. Because either they stay very close or they immediately go away from each other. So I think the whole notion of break time is kind of an informal notion, and maybe we should stop talking about it. That's my feeling. At any rate, so let me now just say a little bit about chaos, which you know, I guess everyone here is familiar with. But I just want to make the point that when we discuss chaotic dynamics, typically what we think about are trajectories. Our general intuition is about trajectories. And even when we talk about phase space, our intuition really is in terms of action angle variables and tori and so on and orbits and stuff like that. It's very rare that we think about how do distributions evolve, right? So the question is, as I showed you before, in the case of weak violation, things look pretty reasonable, and even in the case of strong violation, the final distributions that I get look kind of classical. So maybe if I have to deal only with distributions, I might be able to understand more easily how chaos arises. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case. And for instance, the rigorous definition of chaos, even today, which is kind of annoying, but even today all we know is a Lyapunov exponent. It's basically, the system has a Lyapunov exponent, it's chaotic. If I can't prove it one way or the other, then I'm stuck. Okay. So one we would like to be able to do is to start with an observed quantum mechanical system, get quantum trajectories and show they have, the Lyapunov exponents. And like I said, this is not a brand new idea. People have done this before. And I guess our main contribution was to do this a bit more carefully and try and get some inequalities in place and to actually show that classical chaos emerges. So now here's a quick definition of a Lyapunov exponent. I assume everybody here knows about it. And the only important thing I really want to say is that essentially the Lyapunov exponent is something which is talking about dynamics in a tangent space. Okay, so it's basically Lyapunov stability. And okay, these are some pictures. I guess they're not really worth showing. So the important thing here now at this point is to recap our difficulty with distributions. So one problem that I have with I started off, I was a great fan of distributions, but now they kind of annoy me a little bit. So one of the problems that they have is that often you can have evolutions where the distributions are completely boring. Take a Fokker-Planck equation, start with some initial condition, and because it's a Fokker-Planck equation, eventually you'll go to thermal equilibrium. At the late stage, the distribution function is going to look like e to the minus beta h. And if you try to say, understand how it's evolving, you will learn almost nothing about how the trajectories inside that distribution are evolving. They could be moving in highly chaotic ways because this system could be a chaotic system, but from looking at the distribution, you will learn nothing. So this, I think, is a very serious problem because we are eventually dealing with open systems and we have only a very coarse-grained knowledge of the distribution function, and that will tell us almost nothing. Okay. The other problem is that evolution of distributions on large scales is not easy to connect to the Lyapunov spectrum. So what do I mean by large scales? So let me introduce a concept of the Lyapunov tube. So if you have a particular trajectory, and I start with some initial condition very close to this trajectory, then it'll go away exponentially for some finite separation. Okay. But after that, it becomes non-exponential. And this scale on which that non-exponential behavior comes in is actually very, very small for many systems. So it turns out that how the distribution function is actually changing on large scales may have nothing to do with the Lyapunov spectrum at all. So it's only for globally hyperbolic systems and a few other examples that this is true. So in general, looking at a distribution is not easy to back out the Lyapunov spectrum. In fact, I don't know of any way to do it. And it's also not easy to extract classical correlations, which you expect from, say, Newton's equations, right? So that's the fundamental difficulty with distributions. Maybe there are more. I'll be happy to add to this list. So the fundamental point of view that I have right now anyway, which may change, but right now the view is that trajectories are more fundamental. That's what we want. More fundamental in the sense of being able to talk about chaos. For example, as I already discussed, Lyapunov exponents are trajectory-centric. If you want to calculate that, you need trajectories. Moreover, it's also a fundamental point that even though often we talk about the classical probability distribution, in our minds and in reality, what we really mean is a bunch of particles, okay, which are samples from that distribution. And that's actually physically important. It may be mathematically in an ensemble sense not so important. But there are certain, you know, things, for example, a Nobel Prize were given for appreciating this point. Van der Beer's method of stochastic cooling relies precisely on this fact. For example, if you take a distribution in phase space and evolve it with a Hamiltonian, the area doesn't change. So you might then naively say, all Hamiltonian control methods can't work to cool a distribution. In other words, to make its area smaller in phase space. And the answer for that is that's completely wrong. The reason it's completely wrong is that I don't really, the smooth distribution isn't really what's going on. What I have here is a bunch of particles, okay, which can be represented by small dots. And there's nothing that tells me I can't bring small dots together. Okay. So that's roughly how stochastic cooling works. But that's not what the topic of this talk is. But I'm just trying to make a point that the particulate nature of phase space is important. So now we switch gears and go on. Again, you know, this is like preaching to the choir, so I probably won't preach very long. It's pretty clear that one fact that has emerged, and I guess all of us are familiar with it, is that the old-fashioned way of doing measurement theory is simply inadequate for a large set of problems, ranging from quantum computing to quantum control to, in fact, the extraction of chaos, as I would like to demonstrate. So the whole point is that... Well, maybe it's not, but you know, there are feedback, there are error correction schemes, for instance, that rely on continuous measurements, okay, which have recently been done. So for that, you have to use continuous measurements. So I just assume that everyone knows about the standard von Neumann postulates, and again, I assume everyone knows about POVMs. So the main point I want to make is that the important thing we would like to do in order to get trajectories and to look at dynamics is that we don't want to make obviously very strong measurements, because if you do, you can get a very jumpy behavior. You know, state goes from one place to another place, and that is not what a classical evolution looks like. So it's pretty clear that our measurement strategy must be one, and it makes perfect sense, right? It has to be weak, because anyway, what is a measurement is just some entanglement with an apparatus, and then we are making a measurement on the apparatus, or, you know, and so the whole point is that all this process better be very weak, otherwise we'll change the dynamics of the system so much that to say that it has an intrinsic dynamics itself is an incorrect statement. So in order to disturb more states slightly, we need weak measurements. And a weak position measurement has a large uncertainty in the measured outcome, and that's the whole point. We want to make a sequence of such measurements, and by improving our knowledge, try and extract, you know, localized trajectories. So
a weak measurement wouldn't be localized into a Gaussian.
It'll be Gaussian, but it won't be very narrow.
It'll be broad, right?
It'll be broad, yeah.
It's very mixed.
No, it can be pure. The fact that it's a mixed thing just comes from the efficiency of the measurement. Essentially, what's happening is you have a classical record, and you're conditioning. You're saying, what's the state conditioned on the classical record? So.
And the point is, the weak measurement doesn't mean you don't have much information about your system. It just means that you're getting a small amount of information.
Exactly. You're extracting a small amount.
Just continuous.
Yeah. Well, I haven't come to continuous
amount,
yet.
Yeah. Small amount per measurement, or
weak means you are getting a small amount of information.
It's a small amount of information about the system.
You should say continuous.
No, they're different.
Not yet.
but the fact that it can leave states pure means that there's not more information lurking around that you're not getting.
That's in the highly efficient situation, yes. That's right. There's a parameter called eta which comes in. Okay, so let me see, how much do I want to say about this? Okay, so the idea is that if the measurement strength is strong enough, the system localizes after the measurement. So obviously you want a certain amount of localization, because if the thing is so fuzzy that you can't tell where it is at all, then you don't know what a trajectory is. On the other hand, so you do need some amount of localization. On the other hand, you do want it to be weak because, as I said before, you know, if it's too strong, the trajectory will be too jumpy. So the question is there a regime where the measurement is simultaneously strong and weak? That's what we're trying to figure out. And in order to do that, we have to introduce the concept of continuous measurements, which are a sequence of weak measurements, such that the measurement interval slowly is going to zero. And in finite time, the system disturbance is finite. The information gain over finite time is not equal to zero. And, you know, all these concepts of information gain and strength of a measurement have been studied by Kurt and Chris Fuchs and Jerry Youngman and Andrew Doherty, and you can look at their papers. So for this talk, I will concentrate mainly on assuming that my measurement is good and then seeing how chaos comes out. So let's see. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you say, is there a regime where the measurement is both strong and weak, you mean that for a given time?
You have sufficient localization and yet not too much noise.
Isn't that going to depend on, like, the scale of H bar in your system?
Yeah, obviously, that's the whole point. So, okay, so more or less I've said everything I wanted to say, which is that, yeah, everything is pretty much there, so I haven't said anything new. So now the question simply is, okay, all this was good, how does it actually work? And what happens is the following. The theory of continuous measurement, I should say a little bit about the theory of continuous measurement, which is that it was developed basically in quantum and atomic optics, where there's well-defined physical situations, for example, measuring the position of a mirror, okay, by looking at the phase of a reflected laser. But now what's happening is that in condensed matter, so people are thinking about continuous measurements. For example, Korotkov has an analysis using single electron transistors, okay, for position measurement. And so I think as more and more experimental situations arise in which continuous measurements can be done, they will be done, and you will see more analyses. At any rate, a sort of more or less generalized equation for continuous measurements looks like this. In this particular case, I have this condition density matrix, which has an evolution given by that, where the top line out here is basically the systematic evolution of the density matrix, and a part which comes from the interaction with the measuring device, and the bottom line refers to the increase of our knowledge due to the measurement. So essentially what happens is, if you have an evolution where you're coupled to an environment, but you're not observing, then you have to average over all possible situations, and that's typical master equation that you get. But on the other hand, if you happen to observe and you happen to know which particular, you know, expectation of X or whatever you have to have, that's the measurement record, then the knowledge of your state is improved, and it's conditioned on knowing that fact, and that conditioning is reflected in this term. So, of course, we would like to solve this equation, right? We can solve it on computers. But, you know, solving these equations on computers is fun, but you don't learn a heck of a lot, necessarily. So one of the interesting questions then is, can we actually do some analysis and learn a bit more? And, for instance, we know that we want everything to be localized. So if everything should be localized, then some sort of cumulant expansion should be pretty good. So that means I should look at some sort of GKY-like expansion of that stochastic master equation and see what the equations look like for expectation values of lower order moments. So in this case, first and second order moments. So actually cumulants. So here, terms higher than third cumulant have been thrown out. So the important thing to note that what we would like to be able to get out of this is basically almost classical equations here, right? Because if things are effectively localized, then you should get dxdt and dpdt, and those should be Newton's equations. So you have to make sure that the x variance and the mixed variance, vxt, is small, and moreover, there are conditions on, and out here you have expect of f of x, and what you really want is f of expect of x. In other words, the Ehrenfest limit, right? So if you have those two things, and that will characterize the strength of your measurement, then you're done. But in order to do that, you have to do some more work. You have to say, well, can I sort of show, you know, what are the conditions under which these second cumulants don't go? They don't get fed by the higher cumulants, because in principle, all cumulants are coupled. And so what happens is that you get a certain set of conditions, and those conditions are in our paper. And they're of two kinds. One is essentially a condition which basically makes sure that the blob is always stay the blob and doesn't get broken up by nonlinearities. And this is actually really a classical condition. It simply says measurement should be strong enough that I don't, you know, that things on top of an unstable barrier don't break up. But then there's another condition, which is a quantum condition, and that comes from the two aspects of noise. So one is basically, if I have very weak measurements, right, then I have a major, then I have a big blob, and as a blob is evolving, there's an internal, if you like, uncertainty in what the centroid is, okay, simply because it's a big object, and so I'm not quite sure where I'm at, right? Then, if the measurement is too strong, then the blob is very sharp. It's a position squeeze state, but the kicks are getting very big. Okay. So those two regimes are here. Okay. So this tells you that measurement should neither be too weak, you know, nor should it be too strong. And the important thing to note is that the way S appears, you know, S is the action scale, is that you can simultaneously satisfy these two conditions if the action is large.
Is it true for the equations that you are writing for the conditional measurements that if you average over all outcomes, you recover original density distribution?
You recover the usual
master equation, etc.
Yes, absolutely.
So the averages should.
The averages give you your good old master equation. Yeah, exactly. So now let's look at an example, and the example is, you know, our friend the Duffing oscillator. So now here's explicitly what the Hamiltonian is for Duffing. This is a system that's classically chaotic and all the parameters are explained here, and we have made sure that, you know, we are satisfying all our conditions in the sense that action is big, H bar is small, stuff like that. So a typical quantum trajectory, you know, looks like this. So what's happening over here? Out here, this is phase space, so expect of X versus expect of P. It looks very smooth, looks very nice and classical. And moreover, you can see that the width, the variance in X, remains small and bounded. Okay. So the system behaves in a nice and smooth fashion. So far, you know, now the next question, the proof of the pudding, and then is actually to ask if all aspects of chaos, or of the classical chaos that we expect to arise from this, are correctly treated by the four quantum trajectory equations. And so we looked at two different things. So one thing we did was we looked at a stroboscopic plot. So this is basically taking snapshots of the phase space at the drive at a time period, which is the same as the time period of the drive. And then to see if the quantum behavior and the classical behavior match up. This is actually a fairly sensitive test because the phase space structures can be often fairly complicated and easy to disrupt. And it's really quite remarkable. Here are the two. Actually, I don't even remember which one is which, to be honest. I think
the bottom one's
the quantum one because it has fewer points. Because it's harder to run the quantum simulation and easier to run the classical simulation. So these things are really, really good. So, you know, the phase spaces are essentially the same.
How long a time does that run for?
Oh, this is like, 10 million steps, hundreds of millions of steps. These are many, many trajectories. I mean, the sampling and the number of trajectories are given in the paper.
Do you see diffusion in the quantum case
for
a long period of time?
In the classical case too, because we have driven both of them by small amounts of noise. But the actual diffusion is very small. Over the time period this has run, there's essentially no diffusion. So that's good. You know, once you have a picture like this, you say to yourself, okay, maybe I can even get the Lyapunov exponent. So I should explain something, right, which is basically a question about how do you measure the Lyapunov exponent. So if you actually know the classical equations, then you don't have a problem. You can just run the classical equations and use any number of algorithms to calculate the Lyapunov exponent. But we don't have that. We have some noisy equations of motion, you know, all kinds of weird things are going on. And so what you have to do is you have to just look at the trajectory, and from just looking at the trajectory, calculate the Lyapunov exponent. This is not as simple a thing as you might imagine. I mean, there are lots of books on time series analysis, but, you know, I think the fundamental fact is that time series analysis is notoriously difficult and often gives you wrong answers. So you have to be really careful about time series analysis. And let me give you one other reason why you have to be careful. And the reason we have to be careful is that if you have a nicely chaotic system, then you know, there's no noise on the trajectory. The trajectories are perfect. Okay. So how exactly do you measure a Lyapunov exponent? You say, give me just one trajectory, but give it to me forever, more or less. Okay. So a trajectory which lives in a bounded phase space, you know, comes arbitrarily close to itself and goes away and then comes back arbitrarily close to itself an infinite number of times because it's infinitely long. So it's got an infinite number of quasi-intersection points. Okay. So I can just hang out near an intersection, quasi-intersection point, and calculate, you know, what the Lyapunov spectrum is at that point. Out here I can't because if I'm, this is much too big compared to a Lyapunov tube. So I ask, how many, you know, I go to all the points where the trajectory intersects itself in a Lyapunov tube sense, compute the Lyapunov exponents, average them, and that's my answer. Okay. This, in practice, is very, very hard because it's very hard to get trajectories that long. Okay. The other problem is that we have noise. Okay. So what happens then is that, you know, that noise really screws up the calculation of the Lyapunov exponent here. And this is, again, a huge field, you know, what you do with time series of noise. And, you know, this is something that people make a lot of money on Wall Street. And obviously, I haven't made that much money yet. So we have to find a different method. So the different method is very simple, which is basically start, sorry.
I'm afraid
Ah, the continuous measurement. So you've taken a column system and you're measuring it and then in a continuous way, and you're getting basically a wave function, if you like, okay, that looks sort of like a blob, okay, and it's moving around. And I'm looking at the centroid of this wave function, and I'm saying that defines for me a trajectory. And now I'm going to ask, does this trajectory have chaotic properties?
So you're using the continuous measurement
to produce that.
Learn.
No, I mean the continuous measurement is all I know. I have a measurement record, and I'm saying, well, what do I know about the state of the system, right? And I have an estimate of the quantum state. It's some blob, okay, and it's moving in some space parameterized by time, okay. So that parameterization with time gives me a trajectory, and now I'm asking, is this trajectory have all the right chaotic properties that I expect to get in the classical limit? And the answer is yes, it does.
So is the point going to be that even though you couldn't establish correspondence in quantum and classical with coherence alone,
right,
when you have continuous
right
measurement,
then
you would be able to establish correspondence. But this was done early on sort of at the ensemble level, right?
That's right.
See, but I'm confused a little bit about it, right? Because if what you said before, which is when I average over all the trajectories,
right,
I'm going to recover the master equation.
Right.
Which is correct.
Yes.
Then I'm gonna have an equation which gave me the coherence evolution with the coherence in the first place.
Sure.
So if I couldn't get correspondence at the ensemble level early on,
yes,
just the coherence,
you can't get it now either.
You shouldn't get it now.
No. So the
so
point.
I'm gonna use myself by looking at trajectories. It's fine, but
no. So let me explain the point. I guess I'm not. The point isn't that. The first thing I said is there are two classes of systems. One class of systems has a symplectic classical limit, the other doesn't. The ones that don't have a classical limit, you will not get, even at the level of trajectories or anything, something that looks classical. Okay. So the chance where you have to get something is a system that is only in weak violation of correspondence. When you go there, in order to get a Lyapunov exponent, you have no option but to do trajectories.
Yes. So the point is that you can get a Lyapunov exponent, you continue to study. But
right,
you get the classical limit
in expectation value sense, you don't. You don't.
It doesn't matter whether you
right
keep trajectories.
So if you have classical limit, you have classical limit.
That's right.
It's gonna, decoherence is going to give it to you. If you don't have classical limit, it's hopeless. And you can
I'm
get
not,
some aspects of classical
no, I'm not. Okay.
Like,
I'm saying decoherence will give you the classical limit only if you're in the range of parameters that came out of our analysis of conditional measurement. Yes.
And expectation values tell you you're a little
late. I agree.
Sorry?
Expectation values tell you very little. I
yeah
mean, if
no, but I mean,
you're
have
seeing some average
if you
numbers.
If you have an inconsistency at the level of expectation values, which was...
Oh, then you're dead.
Then you're dead.
Yeah,
right?
Then you're
this
dead
is what I was trying to yeah point out.
You're dead. Okay.
In order to quantify, you need not the effort is going to quantify chaos and necessity. And to do the Kolmogorov synonym.
They're all connected. They're all connected.
You also need the infinitism on the
yeah. They're all connected. Yeah, I thought about that.
But you could do it, I mean, you're right, I mean, you could do it at the level of entropy, because basically the growth of entropy...
We looked at entropy too.
Can I be dominated by the...
We looked at entropy too, there's a problem with that. The problem is, I'll show you a figure. But let me first finish this. So the problem, so first I wanted to tell you where there are no problems, okay, which is here. Then I'll tell you why other things I tried didn't quite work for me. Maybe other people aren't happy, you know, with this, but I think this is really cool. So what we did over here then is we just started, you know, trajectories. Like we'll take one trajectory and start another one close by and measure, and then start another one close by and so on. So this is a very simple way of just sampling how the trajectories move away from each other. Now, so that's what this curve is supposed to show you. Okay, so what happens is that when we start with two trajectories very close to each other, the initial movement away from each other is dominated by the noise. Okay, so because they're dominated by the noise, you see this is a separation rises very sharply. But then that noise is still within the Lyapunov tube. So this was the trajectory, the Lyapunov tube is this big, and kind of the noise sheet, if you like, is that big. So once you go out of the noise sheet, you again are in an exponential regime. Right? And that's what you're seeing over here. And that gives, from that you can back out the Lyapunov exponent. If your noise is too large and the noise sheet is bigger than the Lyapunov tube, you're dead. Okay. So I'm just making this point, right?
Yeah. Isn't it the case that when you go too close to the trajectory, in a sense, these positions are not even particularly well defined? I mean, H-bar is...
Yeah. You're right.
Your blob is going
to be... You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So there are two... When I say noise, I mean it in both senses.
Yeah.
I mean direct kicking noise and also the blobbiness of the distribution. They both contribute. So.
This noise sheet, is actually going to be expanding with some sort of square root of time, right? It's diffusing.
Sure. So anyway, so this basically is the end of showing you how chaos emerges. Okay, so... I guess let me recap at this point, and then we can go off into the extras. Okay. So but basically, I guess the point is that continuous measurement, which, by the way, I mean, I think Todd makes his point very nicely in the first page of, I think it's on the first page of your paper, where you say, it's completely normal quantum mechanics, right? Use it. So let me just reiterate that. This is not some bizarre thing, you know, this is just good old measurement theory applied one step removed from where you normally do it. And I think we'll all need to learn more of it if you need to understand the next set of experiments that are coming our way. And the nice thing about it is if you use it, you know, you can understand how classical chaos emerges from quantum mechanics. Now, before I end, I'd like to say that in 91, there was an interesting paper by Cherkov on quantum chaos where he's talking about something else. But in the first page, he has two paragraphs where he says, you know, one thing we don't understand is how chaos emerges, and that's the fundamental problem in quantum chaos. But I think, he says, that it comes from a continuous weak measurement process. But I don't know how to do it, but that's how it should be. So, you know, I hope that Cherkov will be happy with this. So that's the end of the talk. And then we can go off and discuss some other stuff.
There's one aspect of this I'm quite confused about relating to the first part of the talk, which showed that there were this fact that certain dynamical systems don't give back the classical evolution with appropriate noise added in or continuous measurement coherence. But obviously, it should be the case that, you know, those systems, those dynamical systems, like the Kidd-Broder, for example, if they were in some sense efficiently macroscopic, that I
forgot to say that. I forgot to say that.
Just let me finish. There's one aspect. Usually we talk about, there's a situation where we talk about a choice of the initial state. So whether this initial state has large actions or small actions determines whether that system may or may not exhibit a limit. But now we're saying something a little bit different here.
So we're saying just the same thing. I just forgot to say.
Okay.
So what I forgot to say is that for all systems, when the inequalities over here are satisfied, they are classical here. Okay. But when these inequalities are not satisfied, there are some systems that weakly violate correspondence and some that strongly violate correspondence, and we don't know why. Okay. That's an interesting point.
When you say they strongly violate correspondence, does that mean, so if I took a kicked rotor, obviously I should be able to get back the standard math from quantum mechanics?
Yes.
So, but at the same time, you're telling me that the standard math...
You will get the standard math when the action is sufficiently large. Okay. What is being seen in experiments now is a situation where the action is not sufficiently large. And that's why the experimentalists are having a lot of trouble, because...
But where does that action come into this division of, I mean, the propagator...
It does, I mean...
doesn't depend on the initial action. It's a function of the propagation. You're saying it gets somehow... I mean, that division of L into LC, LQ, and irreversible doesn't depend on the initial action. So well, that's where I'm getting confused. How do I import that initial action into that division so that I see that everything comes out okay?
Yeah, it actually does enter into the initial action. I mean, think of it the other way around. I mean, if you were doing WKB evolution, which would be the naive semi-classical unitary part, there's an action in there, e to the I over h for action. So that's where your action is. It's in the propagator.
So is the problem in the corner where you have just really, you know, few quantized states, one way or the other, which are accessible, and there you don't really expect...
Well, actually, it's quite the other way around, I think. I think what's happening is that the classical regime is like a corner, and there's this, like, huge area in phase space where all hell breaks loose. And we only investigate...
It's also in a parameter space.
I mean, sorry, parameter space. So we're only starting to investigate that, and so I think it's too early to say, you know, what's the set of measure this or that.
But is it generally the corner where h bar becomes big in some sense? I mean, that's what you said. I mean, action versus h bar.
Yeah,
which means the number of quantum states available becomes small.
You're right. So we don't really know because, you know, all we have is a few states, a few dynamical systems. So, yeah, so we haven't really, and like I said, there's no real theory in the sense that in the two, for example, I showed you Duffing and I showed you the, in both of these cases, we try to break those inequalities by roughly the same amount, okay. But one system behaves completely differently than the other one, even though you have this naive argument, okay, how many states, like you said, seems to be...
I'm not guaranteed that it should be the same. But coming back to the point that I was trying to make before.
Yes.
So in some sense, weak measurements by environment are the cause of decoherence.
Yes.
So is there a way to understand your talk differently, that now you're not allowing the environment to carry out all of the information away from you, but you are looking at it.
Absolutely.
And basically,
absolutely.
You know, if you don't insist on looking at quantum chaos from the point of view of trajectories, the dynamics, master equation dynamics must be identical. The only thing that you are gaining, which is important one, is that you are gaining, you know, the image of chaos in terms of...
What we are gaining is how you normally think in terms of chaos, right? Okay. I mean, and I think that really is true, because I think fundamentally that was what the fundamental problem of quantum chaos was about.
The problem is not that decoherence doesn't give you classical...
No. I didn't want to say it that way. I mean, this is like the microscopic analysis of decoherence, if you like. So I just wanted to make one last point about this is something, again, you know, there's lots of these things, unfortunately, can only be done numerically, and our understanding, you know, we are far more stupid computer. So one of the problems that we have is that I just plop this over here, is that we looked at this idea of trying to see what happens to the entropy. We also looked at entropy, we also looked at trace rho squared. Obviously, looking at the entropy is a lot harder because you have to find the eigenvalues of some huge density matrix, but we've done that. I think I have it somewhere, maybe it's in my office. The point is that there is sort of a behavior which has been suggested before. The difficulty is that the slope does not yield the classical Lyapunov exponents. And moreover, the other problem that we have is that even in regimes where we violate our conditions that I had before, the classical and the quantum evolution, by the way, here the green and the dotted dashed lines, are extremely close. So it looks like what this tells me is that even the classical evolution of the entropy doesn't tell me about the classical Lyapunov exponent. So that really causes me some worry. And I think this may well be a question of how mixed the phase space is and where your initial conditions are in the phase space. And that's, again, why I go back to trajectories and I say, gee, you know, this stuff confuses me. So I think we learn more about this as computer power increases, and, you know, I think analytically it's a hopeless situation.
On the other hand, you know, what's very encouraging about your plots, because even though they
as you say, don't match what you expect
from
the Apollo exponents, they are on top of each other. So whatever does entropy classically is going to do entropy quantum mechanics.
Yeah, this is the amusing part.
Yeah.
But we don't know why, which is the not so amusing part.
Mean, as you know, it confirms other things, that for instance, one number above or
yeah, I think it does to some extent, but to be honest, I mean, I think we need much better numbers. Because at the moment, I think this field really is about numbers. If you can, like, the Lyapunov exponent, we can nail it. It's not a question of, like, are we in the ballpark, okay? So if someone is going to make a prediction analytically, they have to tell me, you know, what is the error bar, and then I'll check it. So I think, and like I said, I think once experiments come in the game, then we'll all have to be a lot more careful and all of the sim equal twos and tech papers will disappear. And so I think that's what's really needed.
The vague corner where I would have thought the prediction might be iffy is again where A compared action compared to H bar
right.
is not, I mean, that number is not large enough. That number becomes huge.
Yeah.
I would think that things would have gone out and work.
Could be.
From, you know, what I think.
Yeah, I haven't thought about this entropy thing in detail. So, okay.
Two quick questions. First one, very quick. Does this continuous measurement work differently when you look at discrete variables like energy as opposed to position?
I mean, no. It can be quite different depending on how you do observations, and whether it's QND or if you're looking at a jump process or if you're looking at a continuous leader skip.
Okay. second question. This is sort of with respect to Ivan's question. When you plot the spectrum of the eigenvalues of the classical evolver, the propagator, and some of them were negative in certain cases. Now, assuming there are eigenfunctions that or eigenvectors that correspond to those eigenvalues,
yes.
What I would expect is if you look at the ones, the eigenfunctions corresponding to the negative eigenvalues, they should be, to some extent, localized in that low action region of phase space where have you looked at that?
Yeah, we've been talking about that. It's hard to actually do the numeric because what I didn't show you is like how big the density, the matrix is that we're looking at. We're looking at things which are in the 10,000 by 10,000, okay? And to get the eigenspectrum is already hard, and to get the eigenfunctions is really hard. Moreover, it's not clear what the classical eigenfunctions mean. So we have I have a separate way of thinking about it, which basically uses essentially maps on the maps an autocorrelation function of classical distributions onto periodic orbits. And from that, we hope to learn something. But yeah, we thought about this. What is the corresponding eigenfunction? But it's just a painful thing to do.
You're advocating that we should throw overboard the whole concept of red time. So
well, that's what we're here for, yeah.
You know, Barry's original argument for that
seems
fairly compelling, at least it's a couple of maybe unpullable. But, you know, the idea that, okay, what's going on is in a chaotic system, you get this stretching and folding of the distribution. When the distributions get sufficiently thin, then these higher order terms in the Moyle bracket, corrections to the Poisson bracket should be important. And again, that sounds like a good argument. And you see where those come in, and they'll come in at Pascal's logarithmic in the ratio of active to H bar.
Right.
So what's wrong with that argument?
I don't know. But what I do know is that there are two levels for this argument. One is the question of how good is the semi-classical propagator, right? So there is original calculation isn't about the classical. So there's two types of breaks that we're talking about. Right? One break is, suppose I calculate the semi-classical propagator. Okay. Then how long before the semi-classical theory breaks down in approximating a true quantum answer?
Mm-hmm.
That's one type of break time. Right? The other type of break time is, I compare classical and quantum dynamics, which is a completely different thing, and let's say at the level of expectation values, and we ask, when do they break apart from each other? Okay, so Berry's original argument isn't about second part, it's about the first part. Yeah. Because it's in his proceedings on the Royal Society paper where he discusses the WKB limit of Wigner functions, and then there's a second paper by Balazs and Berry where they ask, how do you do evolution? So if you have a minute, I can explain how this works. Right? So basically what Berry's original paper did, he said, take a classical curve in phase space and construct the semi-classical Wigner function that corresponds to this. So using the theory of uniform approximations, you can do this. You get a kind of blurry peak, and then you get these nice quantum trajectories. I mean, quantum interference terms, okay. Now you say, how do I get evolution? You say, all right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to evolve this curve in phase space using a classical equation. I evolve it a little bit, and I again do my uniform approximation and calculate a new Wigner function. All this will work, but at some point, the closed curve is going to pick up all these very fast oscillations that you mentioned, you know, the so-called whirls and tendrils. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, and the classical curve starts looking, let's say, in some spot like that, then the WKP approximation breaks, okay? Because let's say H bar is only this, and there's too many oscillations in here. So what Berry was saying was that the naive WKP, that the uniform approximation that he was doing might break. But he had no proof, okay? He didn't know if it would really break or what. So what people did numerically, this is stuff done by Eric Heller and collaborators, Tom Sovich, Steve Tomsovich, is that they did very careful numerical simulations in billiards. And they didn't see this break. They saw the usual power law behavior. So now people have asked whether billiard systems are sufficiently universal, but at this point, I don't think there's any evidence for Berry's logarithmic break in semi-classical theory, okay? So I would say that the argument is seductive, but the facts aren't there yet, okay? Now, in terms of the classical thing, there is no real argument, because after all, this was only a semi-classical statement about propagators, right? So about the classical quantum break time, the standard argument that you hear is essentially made by people who do quantum chaos. And essentially what they say is that, look, if you had a wave packet, which kind of defines what an IH trajectory means to me, it'll be ripped apart on a timescale set for a Lyapunov time. Okay? And the H bar comes from the size of the coherent of the wave packet, of the coherent state, you know, and the log comes from the fact that the ripping apart is exponential in time. But all that says is that a classical or a quantum blob will both be ripped apart on that same period of time. So it really isn't a statement about quantum versus classical, it's a statement about ripping apart distributions. So I think that argument is specious. Okay, it simply doesn't apply. And a very good and a good counterexample is the delta kick order. Because you often see things like this. This is the classical thing, and this is the quantum thing. Right from the beginning. On the other hand, in certain other kicking regimes, you can see this. That the quantum thing does that. So I think that, you know, these kind of naive, I wouldn't call them, well, that's, yeah, they are naive arguments, are not right in general. That's just my feeling. Anyway, look, for instance, there's a book, I won't say who the authors are, there's a book on break time. It's a book, and the break time is never defined anywhere in this whole book. So this is what I object to, you know, if I'm going to do an experiment, I'm going to look for something, you've got to tell me what it is very, very carefully and precisely. And no such precise definition of break time exists.